Hi, I'm Zach Hunter, Sports Information Director for the BYU Men's Track and Field Team. I've had the privilege of working with many of the 9 current and former BYU Cougars headed to the 2024 Paris Olympic Games. These former BYU athletes headed to the Olympics have unique qualities and values that they have learned in their time in the BYU athletic system that can apply to anyone and help in everybody's own journey through life. Today we sit down with Ed Eystone. This is Cougar Gold.
We have good 1500 meter runners. We have good 5K, 10K guys. It is fun just to get guys to the games.
The Olympian who builds Olympians. Ed Eystone has arguably one of the best resumes in the world of American distance running. In his time as an athlete at BYU, Ed was a 3-time NCAA individual champion in the 10K, 5K, and cross country, achieving the elusive Triple Crown. In his professional career, he raced the marathon in the 1988 and 1992 Olympic Games and was a 5-time U.S. Road Racer of the Year. He then started his coaching career and eventually became BYU's Director of Track and Field and Head Men's Cross Country Coach in 2013, in which position he currently holds. He as well professionally coaches alums Connor Mance, Clayton Young, and Kenneth Rooks, who each will be competing in the 2024 Paris Games. Coach Eystone is an amazing individual and lives for the sport of running. In our conversation, we talk about his time in the Olympics as an athlete and what he hopes people will know about his current Olympians headed to Paris. And now my conversation with Ed Eystone. Coach Eystone, thanks so much for coming and sitting down with me today. I'm excited to talk all things Olympics with you and just hear your perspective on everything. So thanks for coming in.
Hey, it's great to be here, and I could talk all day long about the Olympic Games. It's an amazing experience, and having participated in the Olympic Games and now having had a number of athletes be in the Olympic Games, it's a great subject for me.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you're the expert on it too. So let's jump into it. So you competed in the marathon in 88 and 92 in the Seoul and Barcelona games respectively. And so what was that like getting into the Olympics through the trials, all of that? What was that experience like?
Yeah, well, it's just... Well, it's such a relief when you do punch your ticket because so much is riding on that one race. We go through Olympic trials. A lot of other countries choose their athletes for the Olympic Games via committee or via how they've participated over a series of events. And the United States, and I think it's probably the fairest, most non-political method, we choose our athletes strictly by a trial. We run a race, and then the first three across the line, by most intents and purposes, are those that will be representing the red, white, and blue at the Olympic Games. And so there's a lot of pressure, especially when you know that if it doesn't happen this year, you have to wait 4 more years, and who knows what kind of shape you're going to be in 4 years later. And so I think one of my more memorable races was at Olympic Trials in 1988 in the marathon. I was at the time a 10,000-meter runner, predominantly, and had run world cross country and done well there. But I was transitioning up to the marathon. And so a lot of people just thought, oh, who's this new young kid on the block who doesn't have the sense to just stay in his lane and run 10,000 meters. And so I was kind of a dark horse, to say the least. But I knew if I could just run as easily as possible for as long as possible and let the experienced marathoners kind of show me the way, then maybe I would have the speed at the end to finish and secure a spot on the team. And that was kind of my strategy in the race. I was the newbie, so I tucked myself in that lead pack and was content to let them pull me along through probably about 16 or 17 miles. And I was such a newbie, I didn't know that 16 or 17 miles was still a long way to go. Mm-hmm. And I was feeling really good, and the pace seemed to lag. So I bolted into the lead and went, okay, I'm going to pour it on for the last 10 miles. And, I learned quickly that that was maybe too impetuous of a move, too early of a move. But fortunately, only a few people responded. I was able to kind of regather. And then Mark Conover made a move. I was able to respond to that move. The two of us were able to gap the field. And over about the last 7 miles, we ran together, forming an alliance, working in the wind, each of us taking a turn, running against the wind to pull away from the rest of the pack. And we were able to run pretty comfortably over the last 3 miles, relishing the fact that we were probably going to make the Olympic team. It was great.
Wow. And what is that like when you find out you're like, hey, I'm going to the Olympics. I'm representing the United States on my chest. What is that moment like?
Well, like I say, it's a culmination to a dream. And, you know, from something at the time I had been involved in heavily for probably about 15 years since I started running in junior high school. And now I was a 27-year-old man, or 26 or 27 at the time. And so I was happy for myself. Obviously, I was happy for my wife and for my family and extended family, because I knew the sacrifices that they had made. And I also knew the excitement and enthusiasm it would generate. In fact, I got a little emotional even late in the race, because I was running and then there was a motorcycle in front of me with a camera perched on the back. And it was kind of, you know, I was staring right into the camera lens, and this was being viewed live across the country. And as I looked into the camera, I just thought, you know, right now my coach is probably jumping off the couch saying, you're moving too early. And my wife is probably screaming and going into labor, because I think she was about 9 months pregnant with our first daughter. and I knew that there were going to be old teammates, college teammates, high school teammates who would be very excited. And when you start thinking about loved ones supporting you and knowing that they were excited, it's easy for you to get emotional. And I remember just having to kind of, push back the tears and go, wait, you still have 5 miles of running to do. Let's finish the job before you start getting all sentimental. But it's an exciting day in any athlete's life, the first time they make an Olympic team, because quite frankly, the vast majority, it's one and done. And so you want to relish that, and you want to make the most of that opportunity.
Wonderful. It's cool to see your perspective from back then of the Olympic Games. How has it changed, you think, over the years since you were in it?
Well, it certainly hasn't lessened in notoriety or publicity. It was a big deal back then in 88, and then a bigger deal in 92. In 92, it had the added awe, I guess, of that was the first year they allowed professional basketball players in the games. And so to have the dream team standing in line with you in the opening ceremonies was kind of a cool thing. I mean, one of my favorite experience, you know, memories of that games is having a nice chat with Karl Malone in the opening ceremonies in the Olympic Stadium. He was had stopped to wave to somebody in the stands, and my file was passing past him as we marched in our Olympic uniforms. And I said, "Hey, Karl, how's it going? I'm from Utah." He goes, "You're from Utah, really?" Well, he said, "What do you do?" I said, "I run the marathon." I said, "Okay, yeah, I've heard of you. Okay, that's awesome. That's cool." And then he said, "Hey, hold on a second." He said, "Stockton, John, come over here. There's a guy from Utah." So there I was with my two best friends, yes. Karl Malone and John Stockton at the opening ceremonies of the Olympic Games in Barcelona, Spain. But it's kind of experiences like that that are kind of surreal looking back on it now. But they kind of help drive home the fact that it's a intense privilege, you know, representing your country and having the opportunity to rub shoulders with some of these superstars that you had admired, during your lifetime.
I think what an experience it was for you. And then your athletes now are going to have similar experiences where James Corrigan could rub up shoulders with like anyone. I wonder how he would handle that.
Well, knowing James, he would probably find some way of, juggling some balls in front of him, becoming really...
Doing his kendama.
Really kendama right there in front of him. It is. That's why you're excited now as coaches to see these athletes have some of the great same great experiences that you were able to experience, and also see the joy that they bring to the people in their life, coaches included, when they have a good race at the Olympic trials. And we certainly had many good races by BYU athletes, both past and present, at the games. All told, I think, don't we have six BYU athletes?
Six BYU athletes, which leads the nation along with three other schools from NCAA programs. So it's we're at the top.
That's
which
pretty
is exciting
solid.
To
That's
see.
Pretty solid. That's what you'd expect from BYU track and field and cross country. And so it's great. We have Whitney Orton and Courtney Wayman on the women's side. And then the guys that I work directly with are two marathoners, Connor Mance, Clayton Young, and then Kenneth Rooks and James Corrigan punched their ticket at the track trials in the steeplechase. So big group headed over. And then let's not forget Rory Linkletter, who is
one of us as well. He'll
be rocking the maple leaf there. And we're excited for him to be in the marathon as well.
Well, and that's what I kind of want to hop into for just from your perspective. Let's walk through the group that you coach, the men that you coach and have connections with. Let's talk about kind of their performances and really just what sets them apart, really.
Okay.
So let's jump into what Chicago Marathon 2023 was like for Connor and Clayton. And from your perspective as their professional coach, what was that race like and what did it mean that they both hit the Olympic standard?
Yeah, so the Olympic Games really, you know, for someone just watching at home, you watch the Olympic trials, and the first three you assume are going to go to the Olympics in Paris. But that's not always the case. In fact, in track and field, in addition to finishing the top three, you also have to have the Olympic standard. And in the marathon, that standard was 208.10 or better. And going into the going into the Chicago Marathon this last fall, there was not one American with that standard. And we really were flirting with the possibility of nobody running in the men's marathon unless somebody ran a fast enough time to get that standard to run under 208.10. And so Connor and Clayton had been working, had been preparing for this race. I felt like through their workouts that they certainly were capable of doing that on a good day, but it was going to take a very good day for them to do it. And the importance of that was for their own sake, but also to unlock two spots on the American team, on the U.S. team, because the USA Track and Field had decided that since they wanted to reward those that were hosting the Olympic marathon trials with good television coverage, they were going to be able to reallocate to the top spots. The top finishers at the trials were going to be able to reallocate any times, any automatic Olympic qualifying standard times that had been run by anyone. So in theory, anyone could have gone out and run these times, and then as long as you were still one, two, or three at the trials, then you would be able to reclaim those, and those times would be reallocated to the first three guys across the line. But up until the Chicago Marathon, no one had even run a time fast enough to even allow someone to, you know, reclaim that. And so it was very important. They had a great race there. They were the first and second Americans across the line, and they were both at Connor ran 207 and whatever 40s or 50s, and Clayton was under 208.10 as well, and ran in 208 low. And so they opened up the spot. They opened up the chance. But the tricky part now was, now that we had two spots guaranteed for Americans to run in Paris, they had to turn around their training and be ready on February 3rd, just a little over 3 months later. They had to be ready to defend the spots that they had just earned. So it was kind of a double whammy on them, but it meant that they were not just going to be content running one great race to get the Olympic standard. They were going to have to run two great races in a row to make sure that they defended their time and were going to go to Paris. And so we had a pretty dramatic recovery, turnaround. In the midst of that, Connor Manske was a little bit dinged up after the Chicago Marathon. He was a little bit injured. We had to rest him a little bit. So he only had about an 8-week build. And wow. Usually we like to do like a 16-week build. But because of his recovering from an injury after Chicago, we were a little bit constrained on time. But the bottom line is they prepared well. They worked hard. We had a strategy going into the Olympic trials. And when February 3rd rolled around and it was Orlando and it was a little bit warmer in Orlando than it had been in Utah in preparation for that. But they had prepared well physically. They'd spent some time in the sauna getting heat acclimatized. And then I think ultimately they were able to execute the perfect race plan. And lo and behold, the two of them were running shoulder to shoulder when it came down to the finish time. They had broken away from third place and they were officially punching their ticket to Paris by going 1 and 2 at the Olympic trials.
And I think it doesn't get much better than for a coach, from your perspective, to have everything kind of execute according to that plan. I know it can probably be stressful with that build up, especially with what you can't control.
Yeah, I mean, it was exciting for sure. I mean, and those of us who've run marathons before know how you can prepare very well, but the marathon to some degree is still a bit of a crapshoot because of all the, you know, vagaries of the marathon. You get a side stitch, or your fluids aren't working with you, or the temperature's a little warmer than you anticipated, or you get a little blister on your little toe that gets bad. So many things can go wrong in the marathon, and so for them to all go right, not on one occasion but in two occasions, and to have those guys finish first and second at probably the most stressful, most pressure-packed race that they'd ever been in was really the culmination of dreams for them and probably for me as a coach.
What do you think is the most like important aspect of what you do during a marathon for that? For the trials, for instance, what are you yelling from the sideline to Clayton and Connor when they pass that one a part of the race?
Sure. I think, you know, all the coaching that is done is usually done leading up to the marathon, and certainly an important aspect of that is just being healthy and arriving to on the starting line healthy. I always say that that's half the battle, because there'll be at least somewhere close to a third of those that should do well end up there either overdone or slightly injured or whatever. The most important job for a coach is to get their people to the starting line fit and healthy. And in their case, I think we achieved that goal. And then the other aspect of it was, in terms of strategy-wise, just to break down with them what would be the best strategy given their current fitness and standing and how things were playing out and the other competitors were looking, what was going to be the best strategy for them to execute a successful race plan that would get them home in first and second place. And we knew that they were fit. We knew they'd run faster than anybody else. Yet there's it's hard to just go out and time trial and run away from people. And so rather than just saying, okay, you've shown that you're faster than everybody, just go out and run faster than everybody. When you do that in a championship style race, then other people will just get behind you, let you do the work, and then they'll take advantage of you over the last bit. And so since we knew their level of fitness was very high and their ability to probably perform at shorter distances was probably better than pretty much everybody else in the field, I drew up a strategy, and taking into account the fact that it was going to be, you know, warmer than what they were used to, with the temperatures probably in the 80s towards the finish line. So we came up with the strategy of chill, cover, and close. Chill meaning the first 10K, we're just going to chill on this. We're going to let somebody else dictate the pace. We're going to be fine not taking it. No matter how slow it goes, we're just going to chill on the pack. We're going to let 6 miles go by without us, having to exert anything. We're going to go to sleep in that pack. We're going to just be carried along by the group of, 200 runners that we're going to be running with. And then cover just meant that after 10K, when somebody got impatient and probably started hammering the pace, you're going to cover that move, okay? Don't let them get away from you. Have respect for whoever is there. Don't push the pace. If they want to dilly-dally around a little bit longer, that's fine too. But if anybody makes a move, then cover that move. Go with that move. And don't lead still. Just cover the move. And then the last 4 miles, I told them, if we've made it to 22 miles and we're feeling good, then you got the green light at that point in time. You can close. Close like a, you know, freight train at that point in time. To give it your best, and you just pull away and punch your ticket, defend your earned spots. And, you know, sometimes you draw up a plan and it doesn't work out according to that because of, you know, what happens, you know, in the race and how you're feeling and whatnot. But this was one of those plans that you drew up and it was executed almost exactly the way you envisioned it. The first 10K was pretty mellow. Zach Panning, right after 10K, put a move on, pretty solid move that kind of destroyed the pack and stretched it out. And Connor and Clayton were able to match that move. And Zach Panning was content to be the leader of that. And Connor Mance obeyed and didn't wrest the lead away, wrestle the lead away from him, was content to run behind him. And then as they approached 22 miles, and Connor was feeling pretty frisky at that point in time, and I think Zach Panning was starting to pay the price of leading at a pretty hard pace. Then at 22, as soon as they got to that point, I was there on my bike, and like clockwork, Mance went wide left, took the lead from Zach. Clayton Young followed, and from that point on, the two of them were able to move well. Panning stuck with him for a time, and then over the last 2.5 miles or so, they were able to pull away and get a comfortable lead.
Yeah, and what a race to watch. I was down there with the boys at the field house, the boys on the team, and everybody was going nuts in there. It was so loud. but what an experience for both Connor and Clayton to do that. Let's talk a little bit about our steeplechasers. So we have Kenneth Rooks and James Corrigan on the men's side, and then we got Courtney Wayman on the women's side as well. People are saying, Coach, that this is Steeplechase U, Steeplechase University. We'll see how that all plays out. But to have three Olympians from the program isn't too shabby either.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't know that we need to be, defined by what we do. We could also say we're Marathon University because we have, three marathoners. True. When you fold in Roy Linkletter into the mix of things. But
we have good 1,500-meter runners. We have good 5K, 10K
guys, but it just so happened that things pulled together this year to work well for the steeplechase. And, the work that Kenneth Rooks has done in being kind of the leader of that group, even though it was interesting because Kenneth and James really did not train that much together in the spring. Kenneth had some reoccurring kind of foot issue going on that was we had to do things a little bit differently training wise. And then James, then the two of them would be healthy at the same time, but then James had to get ready for the conference meet or the regional meet or whatever. So they were just on different schedules. Now, occasionally they would run together, and it was always great when they did run together because Kenneth Rooks is kind of more the mentor. He's the guy who's a little bit older than James. He's been through the program. He's won an NCAA title. All those important things, boxes that he checked before going professionally. He kind of lit the world on fire, so to speak, last year in winning the NCAA championship in the steeplechase in a convincing manner. Big move with about 600 meters to go, and then he just pulled away and grew that lead. And then the USA track and field championships is where he made the big splash, where he was running behind a runner in front of him who stutter stepped going into the barrier, causing Kenneth to have to just barrel roll over the barrier and in the process fall, roll two times, By the time he got up, he was facing the wrong direction. And by the time he corrected that, he was a good 30 meters behind. And when that happens at a USA, you might see that happen at a high school meet where a kid gets up and ends up winning the race. But a USA track and field finals with the depth of talent and Olympians and world standard holders, it just doesn't happen. But Kenneth was smart. He was able to bridge the gap back, regain the lead pack, and then he used his powerful kick over the last 400 meters to draw even with the leader and then take the lead over the last barrier. And it wasn't until he hit the last barrier that he actually did take the lead and push through for the victory. And that kind of became viral of someone of not giving up when you fall, and led into, I think, a whole different era of confidence on his part, which allowed him this last year, even though we had a few hiccups health-wise, once we got those ironed out, he has been pretty much unstoppable in the races that he's run. He's been, you know, he's always been able to close pretty hard over the last 400, and now he's demonstrates that he can do that over the last 800, and that makes, you know, that makes you very, very competitive on even the world stage.
And that's what I've seen from Kenneth too. We sat down with him a couple days ago and we're talking about his real growth over the past year and how it's just been so astronomically high and how has he handled that success. And it was a very interesting conversation to see in his mindset. And so he finished first and he had the highest, he had a high enough ranking that he automatically got into the Olympic Games. However, James Corrigan, he finished third, which was a surprise to many, to you as well. There's a video of you and Coach Waite going wild on the sideline. So he finished third, and like you said, the top three usually go to Paris, but James hadn't hit the standard. No one had, but he was lower on the world ranking, so he was kind of out of the picture. But we still had a week to work with. And so what happened in that week to get him to Paris?
Well, there are a couple things. And even backtracking to the Olympic trials race itself, you know, James had done a very good job making it to the final. He had looked okay at the NCAA championships, but in the final, he was a little fatigued and finished out of being even first-team All-American. He finished ninth. And when you get beaten by, I think all the guys in front of him were Americans. So when you get beat by eight collegiate Americans and then you have all the professionals that you have to wade through at the trials, the fact that he made the final was probably a big surprise. And going into the last couple laps, he was back in ninth or tenth place doing a fairly decent job, you know, maintaining just a little bit of connection, but still drifting off a little bit. And then when Kenny made his big, powerful move with two laps to go, he really strung the pack out. And I think it ultimately helped James a little bit because when Kenny went so strong with two laps to go, many people tried to match that that finishing kick from that far out. And if you go too early in the steeplechase, it can leave you a little bit high and dry in the last lap. And so going into the last lap, the pack was now extended. Kenneth had a comfortable lead up front, and James was back in eighth place. But there was a lot of kind of dead wood in front of him, some debris of guys who had gone too hard too soon. And at that point in time, James just started turning it on and did his normal fast last 400. And as a result, was able to start picking people off. And the reason why Coach Waite and I kind of went crazy there over the last little bit is we were making sure Kenny made it through because he had made such a solid lead. We wanted to make sure that he didn't fatigue. And by the time we went over the last water jump, it was apparent he was going to win going away. And so then our attention went back to let's see how James Corrigan's doing, because last time we checked, he was in eighth place. And suddenly we look and he's like in sixth place, fifth place, fourth place. And that's where I started going crazy, like, look at James, look at James. Look at James, because he was passing and going from eighth place in the last lap to seventh, sixth, fifth, fourth, and finally third place over the last water jump. And then he continued to expand that lead and finish a very comfortable third place. And that was super exciting, obviously, at that point. But we realized, you know, within a minute that his time of 8:26, even though he was finished third at the trials, was probably not going to be enough to elevate him high enough in the world rankings to make it to the Olympic Games. He was going to have to go and chase the automatic time of 8:15, and no American had done it that year.
And the window closed like that following Sunday.
The window
right?
was slamming shut within a week, and unless he could mobilize and go quickly and turn it around quickly, he was going to be shut out, and it would have gone to the fourth place finisher, Evan Jaeger, who's a great American steeplechaser and still owns the American record in the steeple, and had finished just one spot behind James at the trials. And so, we immediately kind of did everything in our power to make sure that, find a meet. And there was one in Uzbekistan, I think, that was scheduled for the next Sunday.
James almost competed in Uzbekistan.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, we knew there was one world athletic event in Uzbekistan, but
because it has to be like a certified.
It had to be a certified meet. We couldn't just find a high school track somewhere and say, okay, we're going to set this up. It had to be at a certified world athletics event. There were only two in the world that were being contested, at least that were open to other. Entrance. One was the Uzbekistan. The second was at Penn, the Penn Summer Series number 2 all-comers meet, basically. And once we found out that was an availability and it was here within our own country, we had a little bit of a hookup to that one because Aaron Robison, who had been a runner of ours, the son of Mark Robison, grandson of Clarence Robison, longtime great coach here at BYU. Once we realized that Aaron was the race director, we immediately called him, double-checked that it was World Athletics certified, which it was. And then he, at the time, they didn't have a steeplechase scheduled, but they said, no problem, we can probably add that. And with some phone calls and some legwork on his part, he was able to get that added. And then it's not enough just to have a race. You have to get people to the race, and then you also have to try to set up that race because he can't lead the whole thing and expect to run like that. So then the search began for someone to rabbit. Kenneth had said that he had a very good experience with a guy who had paced them, who had rabbited the race for them at the Sound Running Meet, where Kenneth ran his season best time.
And for the listeners who might not really know track and field, so a pacer or a rabbit, they run ahead of the pace, but they're not running the whole race. They just do a certain section at the start and throughout the race and then drop out.
They do.
So that the guy behind him can really hit the time that he needs to
exactly. And there have been occasions where the rabbit goes ahead and finishes the race, but the vast majority of them are only selected to run perhaps 2/3 of the race that way in guaranteeing that they can run this uber fast pace. And then they can drop out and let the guys who are planning on running the entire race finish it up. They have to be very talented in and of themselves to be able to function that way, or obviously they'd be slowing down the James Corrigans of the world. And we were just very fortunate that Daniel Michalski was in very good fitness. He had run at the U.S. trials the year before and made the final, actually led a lot of the race to where Kenny fell. In fact, I think in the race where Kenny fell, he was leading the race at the time. But he had also and he had rabbited a race that Kenny had run in earlier in the year. And Kenny said, he does a great job. He's out front. He's really smooth. He's a good technician over the hurdles. And he's a bigger guy. So if the wind is blowing, you really can kind of hide behind him and get pulled along. And the other thing is, Michalski was at the trials as well, but had not advanced to the final. He'd been eliminated in the prelim, which actually was good for us, not so good for him, because had he had to have run the final, then he might have been too tired to be able to bounce back and do the rabbiting duties. But we reached out to him And I think initially he was kind of like, oh, you know, why would I want to do this? But I think he also caught the vision shortly thereafter. And he's good friends with Kenneth, was very good friends with Kenneth before that as well. But I think he kind of caught the vision that, hey, this would be cool to help someone who finished in the top three at the trials, you know, get that final part and, punch his Olympic ticket. So and I think in some ways, Daniel realized that this was a way for him to kind of accomplish his Olympic dreams, at least vicariously, by helping out another runner.
And I think what an amazing race that James did. He broke the 8:15 mark, which was the Olympic standard. So that's an automatic punch to Paris. And really, so he ran those last two laps, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
By himself to cross through. What was it like seeing him come across those last two laps? Because in his words, through these interviews too, he kind of knew with about 800 to go that, oh, I'm on track. Like, this yeah. can happen. And the crowd, I mean, you were there, but yeah. it looked like a kind of a smaller crowd, but like still a lot of people were getting into it.
Well, I thought the crowd did a great job because, again, considering that this meet was the Penn Relays Summer Series number 2 race. Okay. Most of the people that were there were just there for their own fun and to try to see how fast they could run in the middle of the summer. They actually had a pretty good 800 meter race where I think they ran, you know, 145 or so for in the 800, were pretty quick for an all comers race. But then local media had done a good job, you know, televising and letting the word out that there was someone trying to accomplish their Olympic dreams. And so I think we had some track fans. We had a lot of BYU fans there too, some people who were excited about BYU track and field that were there. And even though it was a small crowd, they were lined up and down the home stretch, right up against the rail. And so, and the announcer did a pretty good job as well, I think, keeping the crowd informed as to his progress and where he stood and the time that he had to hit. So, you know, it's kind of hard to do the math three laps out, but when you look at the time with two laps out and realize that, you know, all he had to do was, I think, close in about a 2:08, which is still running pretty hard,
yeah.
64s for the last two laps, but if it was something doable, then things really did pick up. And the rabbit, Daniel, did a great job, took him through 2K. So actually, James had a full 1,000 to run on his own, which is 2.5 laps on his own.
And he closed hard, and it was just amazing to see from my little computer back in Utah, just everybody was going nuts. And my roommate, who doesn't even know track and field at all, I just turned to him. I'm like, hey, stop playing Minecraft. Like, this is history yeah. in the moment. This is a guy our age that's yeah. headed to Paris. And so what an amazing experience that it's been for James. This surprise is Whitney Orton. I just talked with her too. She talks about what a surprise all of these successes has been
yeah.
In her life. And I think for all of these athletes, especially for James too, what a happy surprise. And he really has worked for it too.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think when you're, I think these are the sorts of things that are the expectation when you're a senior or maybe you've graduated and been running professionally for a couple of years, or you've had some really fast times in the past, and so you're considered, you know, a favorite. But for him, just the trajectory, if you think about it, you know, he was at the NCAA meet. He made the final at the NCAA meet, but he finished out of the top. He didn't score a point at the NCAA. He finished 9th place. And then, you know, to move on and then do so well in his preliminary heat at the trials, and then obviously to finish like he did, it just doesn't happen very often. And so in some ways it's been nice because he probably didn't feel the pressure coming in because he was such a long shot. But, you know, everybody loves the story of a long shot making good at the end. And James was certainly with his whole story of finishing 3rd place. And if you watch the rebroadcast of that, you know, the person who was probably surprised the most, but also the happiest down there to give him a hug was Kenneth Rooks when he turned around and saw that his teammate was coming across the line in 3rd place. The look of awe on both of their faces was just through the roof.
And it's amazing to see them and kind of the parallels between Connor and Clayton and Kenneth and James to having two in both of those events is just amazing. And as we kind of wrap up here, Coach, what would you want the average Olympic fan, average BYU fan to know about your Olympians ahead of these summer games?
Well, I think they're just know that they're good. Good people. I mean, they're solid guys who are just, you know, working hard, doing their thing. You know, they're getting their degrees, or in the case of Connor and Clayton, they already have their degrees in engineering. But they're good. In Clayton's case, a loving father of two daughters, and they're all very. You know, put their wives first in terms of, you know, treating them the way that you would want to be treated. And they have set high goals. They've worked hard to attain these goals. They, you know, all four of them. And it's been fun to watch it from this side as their coach. And I look forward to see what they can deliver at the Olympic Games. Already just making it to the Olympic Games. I slept a lot easier the night before the Olympic marathon finals than I did the night before the Olympic trials finals, because in some way you kind of go, well, I've made it. Now, that doesn't mean that they won't have high aspirations and want to do the best that they can in terms of hopefully, you know, bringing home an Olympic medal. But they also realize and are, you know, realistic enough to know that there's a lot of really good people competing in the marathon and in the steeplechase. But I think they're going to give it their best shot. And I think they could come home with a medal. And they could come home with just not a medal, but some great experiences. And already, again, we try to focus on just the process and enjoying the journey. And we're setting some things up so they're going to be able to continue this journey and enjoy this journey. And the good thing about all four of these guys is they are young enough where they could have one or two more opportunities to try to, you know, continue their journey.
Yeah. And what an amazing experience it is for all of them. Thank you so much, Coach, for coming in and sharing your perspective as an Olympian and a coach of Olympians. And hopefully the listeners were able just to understand what is it like in this world of Olympic athletes. And so thank you so much for being on today.
Happy to be here, and we'll all enjoy watching all the fun that happens in Paris.
That was an amazing conversation with Coach. I'm grateful for him for taking the time to highlight his athletes ahead of the games. For a full list of BYU athletes in the Olympic Games, see byucougars.com. Cougar Gold is partnered with BYU Athletics and produced by Cleon Wall, Ethan Horn, and Jonas Guffey. Episodes are available on byuradio.org, the BYU Radio app, and wherever you can find podcasts.